Jackson, who figured that out. And tonight is, what is tonight? It's the 3rd of August, right, 2011. And I want to talk tonight, and then more than talk, open it up for a little bit of an activity if you're up for it, and then also some discussion afterwards. I want to talk about a practice I've been doing lately called See Beings, Not Bodies. And it's in the larger frame of us here this year using relationships as a general topic and focus for practice, both relationships as an opportunity for practice and relationships as a support for practice. So what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about what I've been doing in, inside of a Buddhist frame, and then maybe do a little activity with you if you're up for it. It's optional, and then we can talk more about it. So what in the world do I mean when I say see beings, not bodies? And for me what it is that if I'm interacting with someone, whether it's folks pulling together my, you know, chicken salad at the deli, or, you know, looking at my kids, talking with each other, bickering or not, interacting with a client, or talking with my wife, or being with you right now, it's the ordinary mode of being with others is to kind of see the face, see the eyes, or to see the position, if you will, or the words coming out of some other person, and sort of concretize, you know, a person there, a thing there, an entity there, you know, thingified. And yet, when we see the being, not the body, we see a being, not the body, we sort of blur a little almost our sense of the superficial aspects of the other person, and we see past that, or we hear past it, or we sense or feel past it, or imagine past it, and we encounter something really quite remarkable. When we open to a sense of being, not necessarily the being, as if it's a static entity, one more thing, but rather a sense of being or beingness over there, behind the eyes, behind the voice, behind the words, behind the position, behind whatever's aggravating, right, or whatever's problematic, or whatever we're trying to fix, or defend against, or whatnot, in the other person. And it's quite a remarkable experience. At least it has been for me. It doesn't... For me, it's fairly real to sense a beingness, a process, a vulnerability in the other person, an ongoingness that is deeper than or behind, or back from the surface. And three things have kind of been very much in the forefront of my awareness when doing this with people. I'm doing it a bit by bit, you know, actually as I go, right here and right now, to some extent. One is that there's an immediate sense that the beingness, or being, you know, as a gerund, not a thing, as a process, over there is way deeper, way more fundamental, way more primary and central and core than whatever superficial thing I'm dealing with. Whether it's a superficial thing I like, or a superficial thing I dislike, or a superficial thing I'm neutral about. Their words, their body, their tone. There's something happening there that's much deeper than that. Much as we experience, don't we, very intimately with ourselves, that there's some much more fundamental, much more core process of something or other going on behind our own needs, behind our own positions, or views, or grasping or resisting one kind or another. So something deeper than that. The second thing that I personally experience when I kind of drop into this practice and I play with it, see a being, you know, not a body, is I immediately soften in my own heart. I immediately feel compassion. I immediately resonate with the one, if you'll forgive that language in a Buddhist setting here, the one over there who's like the one over here, or the, you know, the core process over there that's like the core process over here that's so tender and vulnerable and sweet and well-intended, even if, you know, the overall machine of the body mind is doing something that's problematic. Deep down, it's always going to matter. So there's compassion and open-heartedness and softening and feeling less threatened. It's interesting. When I do this, I don't feel so threatened by or pushed by, or I've got to do something about it. You know, the more surface things that are coming at me, I can relax more. I can ease more. I feel less threatened. You know, which is something we talked about at the very beginning tonight of the meditation. So that's the second thing, kind of natural compassion that opens to the other person. And the third thing that's very striking for me is a sense of kinship. It's embedded in that compassion part, but it's additional. It's in addition to that. It's a sense of kinship. Like, what the fundamental process over there is a lot like the fundamental process over here. Because minimally, we both partake of the same nervous system, embedded in the body, embedded in the world, embedded in reality. And possibly, if there is such a thing as a transcendental influence or ground or force or presence or frame, we both naturally partake of that as well. So there's a fundamental kind of kinship over there. And seeing a being, that, not just a body. Okay. Then reflecting on this for myself in a Buddhist frame, there are sort of two key points there. The first is, as you may know, the Buddha is a teacher living 2,500 years ago, not trying to push his views, but offer them much as he did, for people to see for themselves if they had value and benefit for themselves. Anyway, he talked a fair amount about compassion and loving kindness radiating in all directions for all beings. He did so not moralistically, although there's certainly a place, I think, for morals and values and being moralistic. But that wasn't particularly his focus. His focus was on compassion, not because it was divinely mandated or because it was somehow right or moral, but rather that because it was effective in promoting suffering and benefit and promoting happiness and benefit and reducing suffering and harm. It was efficacious. It was pragmatically, utilitarianly valuable. So we talked a lot about compassion. The interesting thing is that if you read his teaching, especially in the Good Translation, which makes them really clear in his original teachings in the suttas and what's called the Pali, which is the language they were first written down in, certainly the surviving record was written down in the canon, the collection of teachings. If you read them, you can see again and again, very interesting, he uses the language of boundlessness, of limitlessness, you know, of not edge or static or perimeter, you know, radiating in all directions without qualification, omitting them. It's that kind of language. So that's one way to relate to, in a Buddhist frame, this notion of seeing beings, not bodies. You know, it's an opening to compassion, which is the wish that others not suffer. It's an opening to kindness, which is the wish that others be happy, usually combined with feeling. And the possibilities to do this in a way that kind of starts to blur the edges of things. And that's one thing that I personally started to experience when I'm seeing beings, not bodies. It's like the edges start to blur. The self-other boundaries start softening, and it starts feeling like we're part of one life. And then, the second sort of Buddhist angle on this, if you will, comes in with, if you know anything about sort of the history of Buddhism, what's called the Mahayana, which started to emerge 500, 700, 800 years after the Buddha passed away, about 500 years before Jesus was born. And the focus of the Mahayana tradition, which is the basis for Tibetan Buddhism, and then Chinese Buddhism, and then Zen, and now as well as Pure Land Buddhism. A very central theme in the Mahayana tradition is the notion of emptiness. Emptiness not as a void or a thing, but emptiness rather as an attribute, as a characteristic, as an adjective of everything, both experience and material reality. What is emptiness? It's based in the notion that everything changes and everything arises depending upon everything else. Everything is intertwined. You know, the lovely, to me at least, Hindu metaphor is Indra's net. You know, this vast web spreading through the cosmos, entwining both, you know, materiality out there as well as the realm of experience and consciousness. And in one of the original metaphors, each node in this web is a mirror that somehow has the ability to reflect all the other mirrors in the web. Right? It's all interdependently arising. Therefore, any single thing is empty of absolute nature. In this way of regarding reality and regarding our experience, there are no things, there are only events. Right? Or as you can find in the language of early Buddhism, Pali, there are no nouns, there are only gerunds. In other words, there are no dogs, there are only doggings. Right? There are no bodies, there are only bodies. And this ancient way of seeing things, arising in an agrarian, pre-industrial, essentially feudal system or time, is now being really confirmed and supported and elaborated by modern quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and appreciation for the ways in which things are continually changing. So in this way of looking at it, again, too, the seemingly brick-like body over there, or solid, you know, the seemingly solid position, or want coming at us, you know, the position that says, I'm right and you're wrong, or the position that says, I want you to do it differently, or the position over there that says, you know, we're going to do money this way, or the, you know, the things out there, the apparent things in Washington, D.C., with debt ceiling deals and positions in political parties and all the rest of that, they're seen as empty. It doesn't mean empty as in, you know, that doesn't, you know, who cares? Let's, you know, like they say in the Hell's Angels, let's live fast, die young, and leave a good-looking corpse, right? It's not that kind of empty. It's not like we shouldn't stand for what's, you know, beneficial and happiness promoting in life, and it's not that we shouldn't stand against forms of injustice and for judgment and harm, but there's a deeper appreciation for the gossamer-like nature of everything, the insubstantiality of everything. And that takes me to, as I wrap up here, the image that you may know from Tibetan Buddhism of the jewel and the lotus. And the jewel is compassion. The jewel is love, right? And in the Mahayana tradition, which focuses on the importance of appreciating emptiness, because, quick sidebar, as one really feels more and more and experiences, starts out often intellectually, and that's a plenty okay place for it to begin. You know, you understand it intellectually, conceptually. Yeah, everything does change. Everything's intertwined. And certainly in the realm of experience, everything is kind of constructed and evanescent, it's transient, it's passing away endlessly. But as it becomes more down in your body, as the Tibetans have pointed out, curiously, there's this natural movement to love. As we feel more of this kinship in the world, as we feel less threatened or frustrated by the things that are solid, the movement of emptiness into the world is, as they say in Tibet, is via love, is love. Love into the world, broadly defined. So the jewel radiating in all directions is love, is compassion. And the lotus is the lotus of wisdom. Understanding, not an accident, rooted in the mud and yuck and smelly crud of a pond where lotuses originate. You know, we need to have an openness to real experience, real life. It's the seed of wisdom, but what we have then is this lotus. So in effect, to put it in kind of modern language, which for me has been helpful, all we have to do in a way is appreciate that it, you know, it don't matter so much, and love. It's kind of simple. To see the world as lots of things don't matter that much. They're okay, but they're transient, they're evanescent, they're intertwining. They don't matter that much, really. A lot of the stuff we think matters doesn't really matter that much. I'm not saying don't deal with the things that really, really matter, but you know, maybe I doubt I'm alone in this room, that my mind gets caught up in lots of stuff that doesn't really matter that much. You know, and as we can appreciate its emptiness, you know, kind of a breakthrough for me a while ago, because I'm a real task doer, as you know, was the statement in my mind, tasks are empty. You know, they have an emptiness, they have an evanescence, a transience, a insubstantiality to them. You know? So we can appreciate that things don't need to, a lot of them don't matter so much. And love. Life suddenly gets a lot more simple. It's a lot simpler, right? It doesn't matter that much. It's okay. We don't need to get our knickers in a twist. And love, one way or another. So that's a kind of a frame here, and I'm glad we still have some time. So what I propose to do in a minute, if you're up for it, is to do a little quiet reflection, and then you'll find a partner, not yet, but in a moment, and talk with your partner about this particular reflection, which I'll tell you about in a moment. And you'll take turns for about a minute or two each, and then I'll give instructions. If you're the listener, your job is actually the most important. And your job is to play around with seeing a being, not a body. And then we'll come back and talk about it. Okay? So the practice to open it up is, see if you can reflect on and have a sense of even being in the presence of experiences of feeling love. Like, when have you felt love? Love broadly defined. You mattered to someone. They were for you. It could be a pet. Could be a spiritual being. Could be a human. Could be someone in your life today. Could be someone from your past. You know, when have you felt love? We'll just take a minute or so. And as you can, kind of open to the experience of feeling love. As you reflect on your life, when have you felt love? Who have you felt loved by? Push through as you can any distractions into feeling unloved or unincluded or uncared about. And come back to, when have I felt love? Especially broadly defined. And especially allowing the relationship to not need to be perfect or love to still be there. We'll just take a minute or so back. And be mindful of what it feels like to feel love. In your body, in your heart. You might even put a hand on your heart or a hand on your cheek to support this experience. In your mind. What's it like to feel love when you have felt love? Can let yourself feel happy about feeling love or fed in some way. Notice how feeling love in a way, has a boundless or edgeless quality to it. You can't put a fence around it. You can't locate a fence around it. In your mind, feeling love has no edge to it or bound. Okay, and then, you can always opt out. If you could, please find a partner, stay in this room, but feel very free to spread the chairs out. Pick an A and a B. A's will go first, talking about the experience, and then I'll give you time signals. So if you could just, even before diving in, grab a partner, spread out, and you're going to tell your partner what it was like for you, a little bit at least, to feel love. Do you mind? Grab a partner if you're willing. Don't be shy. Pick an A and a B. Feel free to spread out to give yourself a little privacy or, air time or air space. All right, you may have started already, which is fine. A's go first as the speaker, B's listen, and B's, as you can, just play with and explore. What's it like from time to time or as much as you can to see a being over there, to be with a being over there rather than so much a body or a series of words or a sex or gender or race or history or age. You feel the being that's kind of ageless and genderless and beyond personality behind the eyes. Okay, begin. A's begin. Take about 30 more seconds. A's, 30 more seconds. Wrap it up. Okay, now time to shift gears. B's, you're going to be speaking, and whatever you want to talk about, particularly hopefully related to times you have felt loved, what it's like to feel loved, and so forth. And A's, you, as you can, are going to be recognizing or hanging out with or seeing a being, not a body. Okay? So B's, begin. Thank you. B's 30 more seconds. Wrap it up, please. And when you can, just bring your attention back. Maybe shift your chair if you don't mind, or go back to your seat if you like. Okay. So, we have about 10 more minutes. I like to try to end close to 8:30 out of respect for people. I'll stick around a bit afterward. And those of you who'd like to help out, sort of straighten up here, your efforts are very welcome. There's also opportunities upstairs. So, what did you notice? What was that like for you? Particularly anything related to, feeling, sensing, knowing, imagining, seeing a being there, not just a body or a personality or a stream of words. What did you notice? What was that like? Great. Sure, thank you. Great, great, great. I know a lot of people who do. Maybe because I'm a therapist, but, I've been in the, a lot of people aren't so sure about feeling loved. Or it's not an ongoing experience. And, as you may have heard me say, as we evolved, death, exile was a death sentence in the Serengeti. We really need to feel loved, broadly defined, included, cared about, cherished, prized, seen, empathized with, and lots of people have much less of, stability of that felt sense. That said, yeah, ultimately, love's the big bath, right? Yeah. All right, so what we marinated. Okay, yeah, please, great. Okay, great. Yeah, a different variation for me is it's not so important. One has to be careful about not getting into dismissing or minimizing, especially if one has a tendency, maybe from childhood or life, what have you, to diminish the pain one feels or what's actually happening for oneself or others. There's an art to this, and I think another word for it is equanimity. I think the lotus is equanimity, is balance, is seeing the whole picture. Seeing the really big picture. I have these screensavers where I see galaxies routinely on my desktop and my computer. That's the really, really big picture, Or think about time, the endurance of time. How many generations have passed, really, since humans first began making stone tools? So it's in that frame that I'm talking about, language like, it doesn't matter so much, or it's not so important, and love. But in particular, what is it like to intuit a being over there? What happens to you when you open to that? Which for me sometimes is so powerful it can take my breath away. What's that like for you? Yeah. Where else? Thank you. And to underline, what happens over in you that lets you receive being over there, which is over everywhere, here and now, right? As Tricia would say. But, you know, what happens in you that opens it so you could be present with, you know, beingness over there? Great. Yeah, a couple more, then we'll move to a wrap. Yeah. Thank you. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah, feeling loved as a little kid, for sure. Yeah. Anybody else? Maybe a couple more? Just anything you noticed or want to comment? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. For me, this practice partly is about attention, because it's so continual. The brain continually tries to stop the flow of life to create things that we can either go get if they're carrots, or run from if they're sticks, or fight if they're sticks, right? So the brain's continually taking flow and trying to freeze it and thingify it, which creates an inherent dukkha or stress or tension that's intrinsic to being an animal that's trying to live. And so part of the art is to not let attention be conventionally taken as it is usually by the word, the personality, the tone, the import of what the other person is doing right now, and to kind of divide your awareness. It's a little bit like a concentration practice where you, no matter what's happening around you, you stay on the breath or something. In this case, you stay with that growing felt sense of being over there, which, as you said, sure, has a, well, you probably implied as well, has a more universal quality. You might explore that. What's that like to not, when the other person is doing their thing, good, bad, or indifferent, not being so captured in your attention, and being freer to sense past it. You know, to sure hear the words, don't be inappropriate, but to sense past it to something very primal and vulnerable on the other side of it. Maybe one more person and we'll finish up. Did you want to say something? Or 28. I think one thing that psychologically, neurologically can help us do this practice of being over there is to feel like we're somewhat full, at least over here. So that was part of the method to my madness in starting with the felt sense of receiving of one form or another of caring, to be able to be more comfortable, you know, casting loose in a way from familiar moorings and being really over there in a potentially very deep way. You might help yourself, too, by calling in or opening to feeling cared about one way or another as a way to kind of be freer to be over there. quick announcement that next week I'll be in Australia having a good time down under, doing some conference and also hanging out with my brother. I'm going to have a vacation, oh my God, for at least a little while. And wonderful news, next Wednesday the 10th, Linda Graham, a superstar teacher here, as well as legendary Sylvia Borstein from Spirit Rock and many other places, will be here jointly presenting, talking about generosity and themes related to that, in part related to a fundraising campaign that's emerging to build a new community hall at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, my home practice community, as well as other key buildings. So this would be a great evening next week to come to. It would be probably really great to bring friends, too, if you're moved in that way. The evening will start at 6:45 as usual, but I suspect this room will be quite full, and so you might want to come particularly early. And there's information about that I've sent out to everyone. If you would like to get on the email list for the sitting group, please leave me your name and email address on the yellow pad back there. I'll never share your name or your email address with anyone, and that way you can get announcements like what's going to happen here next week. Okay? So how about we sit quietly for a minute? Oh, and as you do this, here's the other, guess who the other being to recognize behind all faces, behind all positions is? It's the one over there. It's the one over here. Can you be intimate with the being over here, behind your own eyes? Under your words, behind your personality, prior to positionality, that fundamental process in yourself, can be intimate with that one. Thank you for your practice.